inviting me back. I must admit, this is a slightly strange format, and if that translates into a performance that's below its normal standards, then please forgive me and bear with me. Elkan suggested that when I speak today, I might want to dwell on the theme of personal responsibility and community, which is, of course, what I always end up speaking about. And in my defense, while I concede that it's possible that the reason I keep finding this theme is because it's what I'm looking for, I think it's also possible that this is actually a fundamental and pervasive theme, and that's the reason why I keep finding it wherever I look. I'll let you make up your own minds. So TUV marks the final stage in an iterative process where RN is gradually introduced to the kahuna. And it began way back in Shemos when Hashem first told Moshe that RN would share the leadership with him. And then in Tetzaveh, just a few weeks ago, the theoretical instructions were given. But now Aaron is given the instruction to put the theory into practice and actually commence the service. And I can't say that I find it as easy to summon enthusiasm for the Sedras of Vayikra as I would for, say, the ones in Bereishis and Shemos. But for even for people who do enjoy the unending details about the Karbonos, and I'm sure such people exist, TUV seems like an oddly repetitive, especially following Vayikra, on the basis that most of what we see here was already said last week. And what little new information is added could easily have been included in the first presentation. So we're forced to ask ourselves, why would the Torah go to all the trouble of repeating everything again, but then also presenting it somewhat differently? And of course, if we want to access that nuance, the first thing we would do is look at the immediately obvious differences between the two accounts to see if they point to any clues. And the most obvious one, I suppose, is that Vayikra was addressed to all of the B'nai Yisrael, while TUV is specifically addressed to the Kohanim. So it would be tempting to think that perhaps Vayikra is a general introduction to the Mishkan, while TUV is more specifically focused on the duties of the Kohanim, except for one rather inconvenient detail, which is that Vayikra actually presents the duties of the Kohanim in much more detail than TUV does. So it's clear that TUV is not an instruction manual. And what that means is it must be defining something more fundamental about the paradigm of Kohen, what their role is and what their relationship to Hashem is, and of course to the B'nai Yisrael who they represent. And I think it's for this reason that the Mefarshim spend a lot of energy trying to understand the word TUV, and the mode of engagement they imply. So TUV is an interesting word. It's quite rarely used, but it's used in places where you might normally expect to see the word daber or emor. And that, of course, begs the question, what is the mode of engagement or communication that's denoted by the word TUV, and how is it different than the words daber and emor? It's interesting to see that when the original theoretical instructions were given, and here as well, the same word is used. So previously it was Vatot Tzaveh, and now it's Tzaveh Zaharim Vesbonov. So we turn straight to Rashi, and Rashi says in a short comment, Ein Tzav Elo Lashon Zeiruz Miyad Uladoros. He says that the words or the terminology of Tzav is the language of urgency, immediacy, and continuity. So he uses just three words, but I think all three are somewhat separate. And there is some discussion about whether TUV is only used when all three apply or just when any of them apply. But we'll come back to that point. The next, Rashi then goes on, Omar Rabbi Shimon, and he's quoting from the Sifrah, he says, Omar Rabbi Shimon says, B'yoset Tzorech HaKos of Lazarus B'mokim Shiyesh Bo Chesron Kis. The Pasuk has to particularly emphasize the theme of urgency when there is an underlying risk of financial damage. Now, this is a bit difficult to understand because it's hard to see where the Kohanim would actually financially benefit from their service. So the question is, firstly, what is the implication of Rashi's three criteria for use of this terminology of TUV, and what's the connection between them? Specifically, what's the connection between urgency, immediacy, and let's call it intergenerational continuity? In other words, what on earth do these things have to do with the Kohanim? There's also the other question, which is, you know, what type of financial loss is Rabbi Shimon concerned about? And how is it relevant here? It's not immediately obvious how financial loss applies to the Gurnah. So I'll quickly cover Rabbi Shimon because I don't really want to dwell on it. There are some of the Mepharshim, like the Ramban, says that he's giving a general rule. It's applicable in other places. It's not applicable here. And there are others who say, yes, there is actually a financial loss associated with the Gurnah because they have to be extremely careful not to somehow invalidate a korban that was donated by someone else through being not careful enough or something like that. You've also got others like the Maharal who say that, you know, the Kohanim are giving up their livelihood in order to be Kohanim, so there is a financial implication. And as I say, I'm not going to dwell on this point, but I am interested in exploring any possibility. There's an underlying theme that connects the criteria that we mentioned, the urgency, the immediacy, and the continuity, and perhaps also the theme of financial loss. So I saw a really interesting and very compelling approach that was suggested by Rabbi Shmuel Goldin. He's a Rav in New Jersey in America. And I've sort of built on his underlying theme a little bit, but I'll say it more or less as he did. So there are actually two ways to apply the word tzav and the urgency they convey. So the natural one is that it applies to Aharon, but you could also interpret it as applying to Moshe. Now, you'll recall that Moshe has had issues in the past with sharing responsibility and trying to do too much himself. Right? And this is exactly what Yisro railed against when he saw that Moshe was trying to be the halachic leader and halachic advisor for the whole of Bnei Israel. And he says to him, it's just not sustainable. It can't work like that. You won't survive. The Bnei Israel won't survive. And perhaps a similar thing is applicable here. Moshe has known for a long time that Aaron was going to take the kahuna, but it's at this point that the handover actually needs to take place. And Hashem says to him, don't hesitate. The time has come for the next step in the national development. And to facilitate that, you, Moshe, need to share the responsibility. And that must have been very difficult for Moshe, because when you consider that, at least according to some, he himself was originally destined to be the Kohen. And until the episode of the burning bush, when he resisted the leadership and Hashem eventually said to him, summon Aharon and he'll share the responsibility with you. So Hashem says, Moshe, the time has come now to show true leadership. And the way that you do that is by relinquishing a portion of your power in order to allow others to thrive. And that's a really hard step for somebody who's as invested in the leadership as Moshe is. But the key here is that this explains not just the urgency and the immediacy, but it also explains what the Ladoros is, this intergenerational element. This handover of power is not just about sharing responsibility here and now, but it's about protecting the continuity of the institution of Kahuna. Moshe and Aaron wouldn't be around forever, and they need to train a new generation to continue when they've gone. And with this fundamental principle in mind, we could just as well apply the word tzav, not just to Moshe, but to Aharon as well. What was really important is that Aharon understood that this wasn't just for him, but for all generations. If Aaron had tried to do it on his own, he would have been the end of the line. There wouldn't have been continuity. There'd be no Ladoros. So what we see is that true leadership is not about power, or it's not about the power that the leader holds, but how he can empower other people, which guarantees the sustainability of the institution. And we'll see that establishing the paradigm of what kahuna is, Hashem used this mode of speech which demonstrated that what's being established is not just an immediate priority, but one which was destined to be an everlasting institution. Because for a community to be sustainable, it's not viable to have all of the power invested in just one individual, present company excluded. So I won't dwell any further on that point, but as they say in yeshivish parlance, hameivin yobin. So we might understand a little better what the nature of this mode of engagement is, and even a little bit more of the nature of the kahuna, but there's still a nagging problem. And it's this: in the modern generation, with our enlightened sensibilities, isn't there a mildly troubling undertone about the whole kahuna arrangement? We've witnessed the Bnei Israel going on a journey towards acceptance of individual responsibility within the context of social and communal cohesion. And against that backdrop, we would have expected such an honour and such a responsibility of being a Kohen to be linked to personal merit. As a condition which is simply inherited, so you're born a Kohen, you don't earn being a Kohen, there's a flavour of privilege which our woke generation must be slightly uncomfortable with. And actually, when we look at this, it's not just the kahuna that commits this this offence. The same just as well applies to being a Levi who gets to participate in the service as well by dint of his birth, or a firstborn who had no choice to be born first, but as a consequence has additional rights compared to his siblings. The same applies to differences in the obligations between men and women. And, you know, given that the theme of my chabur generally veers towards personal responsibility, how are we supposed to reconcile this with the automatic granting of privilege through birth? Aren't we more sophisticated than that? So I think to address this properly, we need to expand our search beyond the immediate focus, because actually in other respects, Judaism does behave much more like a meritocracy. So if you look at Avraham, for example, he wasn't chosen because of his genetics, but because of his own achievements. Moshe, despite the privilege which he had in abundance, having grown up in the palace, he didn't distinguish himself by that, but through his character and through his conduct. I think even more fascinating is that when you look at the stories of Bereishis, it's actually almost comical to see the privileges consistently undermined and usurped. In every generation of the forefathers, we see that the firstborn loses his rights to a younger sibling. Yitzchak became the heir to Avram's legacy when it says, "Ki v'Yitzchak yikari l'chozora," not his older brother Ishmael. Yaakov took the birthright from his older brother Esav and took the blessings that were destined for the firstborn. Yosef's younger son Ephraim is given precedence over Menashe. And the firstborn sons, who were originally destined to perform the service in the Beis HaMikdash, they lost this at the time of the Golden Calf, and it was given to the tribe of Levi instead, who merited it. We also see in practical halachic terms that, you know, when it comes to things like benching, a Talmid Chacham is given precedence over a Kohen. And in fact, according to many, even in Shul, when we're going through Aliyos, a Talmid Chacham would be called up first in place of a Kohen, if not for the trouble that it would cause to the poor Gabbaim who have to decide who's considered a Talmid Chacham and who isn't. So, but in principle, that would apply as well. We see that full descendants of the Avos who were born into Judaism or into the Jewish nation, those who didn't merit to leave Egypt, they disappeared into history, whilst other people who made the choice, people of any descent who made the choice to join the Bnei Israel, they were treated as full members of the Jewish people. So it seems that once again we're confronting these opposing forces of community, which affords automatic membership, and individual merit, which has to be earned. And most importantly, we see that when there's a conflict between the two, between the individual and the community, or the personal privilege and the merit which has to be earned, it's always personal merit which wins. And we all accept the fact that birth can confer on a person all sorts of natural advantages, genetic advantages, physical advantages, mental advantages. You know, a person can be born more or less intelligent. They can be born weak or strong. They can be emotionally intelligent or the opposite. The Torah is telling us similarly that birth can confer on a person the advantages of certain social or communal opportunities, but they're incredibly volatile. They can vanish if you don't justify them through your personal merits. On the other hand, individual merit on its own isn't a recipe for effective community, as we see through Aaron and sons. There needs to be a structure to ensure organization and continuity. And I'd say that, you know, those who have seen the studies that looked at the genetic markers in the Kahuna, and they've seen that, you know, that there is a common ancestry to all of the Kohanim. You know, I'm not going to go into the details of it. It's very interesting to look up, and I'm not an expert in it by any means. But what we see is that this theme of continuity that was ensured through the words of Tzav has been quite successful. And this brings us back to the word Tzav. When Rashi told us there's these three criteria, immediacy, urgency, and continuity, we see that these actually relate to the two opposing forces. The immediacy and urgency, which, you know, we often refer to as zrizus, those are personal qualities. But the other critical element of the kahuna is intergenerational continuity that comes from the self-organizing force of birth privilege. Neither of them is enough on its own, but the hybrid between the two defines this new era of relationship with God that they're about to embark on through the kahuna. I know we're coming up to 9:15. I just want to take 2 more minutes to wrap this up with one final thought. There's a fascinating medrash at the beginning of this week's Sedra as well. I won't read through the whole thing given the time, but I'll just say this. So it records a conversation between Moshe and Hashem. And Moshe says to Hashem, having seen the way that all the details of the Kohanim were laid out, and he says, I don't understand. You've given all of the responsibilities to the sons of Aharon, but nothing to Aharon himself. You've rejected the source and you've embraced the offspring. Why is it? And why did that happen? And he goes through a lot of detail explaining why he was offended by this. And Hashem then turns around to him and he says, Omalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chayecho, by your life, Shebishvilcho ani makarvo, on your behalf, because of you, I will draw Aharon near. Velo od, and not only that, Elosh ani osa oso ikar uvonov tefelin. I'm going to make him the primary and his sons the secondary. And then he goes on to say, Tzavez Aharon v'es bonov lemar. And that's the reason why it's broken out Aharon and bonov on the other hand. I want to ask two questions on this medrash. The first is, was it really necessary for Moshe to have to pray for Aharon? I mean, how did it somehow change Hashem's mind? Was Hashem not planning to involve Aharon in the first place? The second question is that the particular role that was actually given to Aharon as the primary, the Ikar, seems a very curious choice. Effectively, what his role involved was sweeping up the ashes of the karbonos and taking them outside of the camp to be disposed. Is that a job fitting for the archetype of the kahuna, for the primary, you know, the quintessential priest? And I think we can answer both of these questions and understand the Medrash better using the framework that we've proposed. Why did Moshe have to daven? It wasn't for Aharon, it's because this was part of Moshe's journey. Hashem wanted to see that he, Moshe, had taken on board the message of Tzav. And then not only was he willing to relinquish the power, but actively to seek the partnership of his brother Aharon in the leadership. And as for the second question, if the other aspect of Tzav is to show that privilege is nothing more than a tool or a device to maintain intergenerational continuity, that means it's nothing to be proud of. And what better way to demonstrate this than by giving the lowliest of jobs to the greatest of men, to prove that there's no innate superiority on account of being born a Kohen. It's just the privilege of opportunity. And if that opportunity means doing a job, however menial that is, then Aharon, of course, would grasp it and prove to everyone that privilege isn't an invitation to lay back and bask in the honor and glory of your birthright, but it's a device for exercising individual responsibility and gaining personal merit. So may we all merit to use these very special circumstances that we find ourselves in to find our own individuality within our wonderful community. Good Shabbos.
It's absolutely brilliant.
It's good.
Thank you
very much.
That was amazing.
That's
a really good idea.
Fantastic.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Thanks, Daniel. That was great.
Yeah, Daniel. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody's unmuted. You've got a few minutes to chat and say hello and say
Daniel.
Esther.
Very, very interesting talking about leadership because it's so relevant, not just within the community, but also in the places where we work, which are having to change the whole mode that they operate at the moment. Thinking specifically of school, better leaders are the ones who share. And it's absolutely true. There are some leaders, unfortunately, who want to take all the benefits and the privileges for themselves. And therefore, when their goal is when they're not running the institution or the community, that the community fails. And that's what makes them feel that they've done a good job. But in reality, it's the exact opposite. So I thought that was really relevant. Thank you.
And as I said, I'm Maven Yovin. You're clearly a Maven.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you for joining.
Thanks, Daniel.
Bye, everyone. Daniel. Have a lovely day.
Good Shabbos, if I don't speak
to you. Good Shabbos,
everyone.
Shabbos.